the XCast X-Files Podwatch, Episode 12. Today we're going to be covering two episodes from Season 1. The first is Born Again, and then also Roland. I'm your host, Russ Hugo, covering for Tony Black, and with me is Lauren Forey.
Hey, Russ, how's it going?
The last episode we talked about two, what I think we both considered, fairly classic episodes, Darkness Falls and Tombs. So Born Again was originally aired on April 29th in 1994. It's episode 21 of the first season. It's written by Howard Gordon and Alex Gonza, very prolific, and directed by Gerald Friedman. All right, so if we could start, would you mind giving us a brief summary of Born Again?
All right. So Born Again follows a slightly creepy child from Buffalo, New York, who somehow, when locked in a room with a police detective, gets the police detective thrown out of the window or throw himself out of a window. It turns out that this girl named Michelle, she might be either possessed or have schizophrenia or some sort of psychokinetic, telekinetic powers that cause people to kill themselves. And as the episode unfolds, we realize she is actually somehow reincarnated or possessed by the spirit of another detective named Charlie Morris, who was murdered through a conspiracy amongst other cops, involving that cop that was thrown out of the window, as well as two others. So it's a race to figure out, you know, how they can stop this possessed little girl from killing the last man. And in the end, Mulder and Scully are able to kind of help bring a resolution. But the main person that brings a resolution is the dead detective's ex-wife, who sort of through the power of love convinces the ghost not to kill her current husband, who was one of the conspirators. And it all kind of ends happily ever after, with the little girl having friends and not being as creepy, finally.
Yeah, and getting over her fear of swimming.
Yes.
Too.
Swimming in the pool. Since the man was drowned in a tropical fish tank is how he had died. Which might be, for me, the most interesting thing that the episode has.
Well, to challenge that point, it does have some of the first elements of continuity in the show. When the one cop's brother, when Mulder and Scully asked the cop, how did she hear about them? Said from her brother in Baltimore about the Tombs case.
Yes. Which actually, that was really nice because, like we talked in the previous episode about that weird gap between Darkness Falls and Tombs, this one you could see, you know, happening a few days, maybe a few weeks later. So that it's nice to see some of that continuity finally, you're right, coming out as we get towards the end of Season 1.
So you mentioned that the fish tank drowning, which is can't argue with that as being a highlight, but I'm going to be a real pushy co-host here and ask you, play devil's advocate, are there any other highlights or things that you found interesting or enjoyed or things that you really didn't like?
Well, I think it has a really nice setup, this episode, before the credits. Because you have the detective who's walking out, clocking off work. You know, it seems like a normal day, and she sees this young girl just sitting by herself in an alley. She's like, ooh, why is that girl here? Clearly, something's going to be up because it's an X-Files episode. And then when she's brought into the room with the detective and suddenly the guy's thrown out of the window, and you know an 8-year-old girl couldn't do this, it's pretty fascinating. It's like, oh, what is it going to be, you know, that we haven't seen so far? So I do really like the setup of that. For me, I think what happens with the rest of the episode, though, is that it's revealed too quickly and too easily really what's going on. There's a little bit of debate about if she has powers. And then what happens is they kind of reveal that it's actually this detective, and through scenes that Mulder and Scully are not in, already we see that, oh, there was a conspiracy, they killed the guy, he's doing it for revenge, and the episode kind of, for me, trudges along from there.
Yeah, I do agree that it did give up the ghost a little bit too early, if you'll pardon the expression. About the relationship, the characterization at the beginning, at first I thought it was a little over the top and kind of foreshadowing that the cop would die. Is the cop who walks out makes comments to the other cop about fairly sexist comments, you know, things like a piece like you. And what I found that they kind of did moderately interesting is they kind of balanced that out by she still was very polite and friendly to him, even though he was clearly this person. And then the comments made later that most people actually didn't like him. And so I had the one cop was maybe one of the few people who tolerated this jerk who ended up dying, even though he was very unsympathetic.
Yeah, they could have even done more with that a little bit, probably, like show more people not liking him or show she was like the one person on his side. But yeah, there are not much other things to get in, like origami.
Yeah, no,
exactly. What I was hoping was, is because I thought that was making the main cop that we were following fairly interesting, and then halfway through the episode, she pretty much just disappears from the plot and the script. And that was something I didn't really like. I was hoping that they would flesh her character out a little bit more, because at the beginning, it seems to be going somewhere, and it didn't.
Right. I mean, the camera really focuses on her. She's the one that finds the girl. She starts making these connections, and then you're right, then it's like she didn't have any purpose in the plot anymore, and they couldn't figure out what to do with her, so she just wasn't there.
What did you think about the actress who played Michelle Bishop, the little girl?
I thought she was actually really good. I mean, X-Files has a lot of creepy kids pop up throughout the whole series. And I thought she interested me enough that I actually looked her up on IMDb to see what she's up to now. And she's actually a full-time voiceover artist. She does a lot of cartoons like My Little Pony and a bunch of others. But there's something about, you know, her stare. Like, it's not as creepy as, like, the little girls in Eve. But it's just something you can see that she is a bit off. And it's believable.
Mm-hmm. I thought the direction was very nice compared to sometimes some of the X-Files kids will ham it up a little bit or play too Village of the Damned calm style. And I thought she was just very nice, just staring straight ahead in what she needed to. And it worked well. It's good to hear that she's doing other work.
Yeah, she has that one moment when they're doing the composite sketch and Mulder gets her to laugh with doing a crazy mustache. So it's like, yeah, you got to see her as like a real little girl. And then it's, you know, there's a moment and she like, somebody changes the computer without touching it, and it goes back to creepy. So you could see that there was a real child underneath whatever's happening to her.
And that actually brings up one of my favorite things. There's two favorite things I'll talk about, but one of them is that computer changing the sketch artist software.
Oh, yeah.
And I know there's a lot of stuff, you know, people could laugh about computers and even TV shows now, but in the past about zooming in and enhancing, just hilarious ideas of how hacking works. But that software and what the cop that was assisting them was able to do with a keyboard, that was wonderful. And the fact that this girl not only can cause people to jump out windows and not only can it cause scarves to get caught into buses and make buses accelerate, but can cause software to redraw faces.
Mm-hmm. That moment, I mean, there's something every time I watch an old X-Files episode, I look at the technology and it makes me sigh. You can't help it. But I don't know. Don't they still draw now? Microsoft Surface tablets and doing sketches that way?
That would make sense. And I want to be clear here. It's so joyfully outside the bounds of reality that they're not really even trying. And it doesn't matter. And even just the way the graphics look and everything else, it's such a time capsule we'll never get back. That whole scene is... it's heaven. I also want to throw out my second favorite thing about this episode, which is you may or may not remember it, but Michelle's mom, when Mulder first meets her and is talking to her, did you notice the couch
that she was sitting on?
I did not pay attention to the couch.
It's incredible. So if you do a X-Files watch again,
pay attention to the couch.
It's a highlight. It's almost worth thinking about getting a screen grab and put it in a Facebook group for the X-Cast. It was nice. One other thing that was, I don't know if it was the first time I was going to ask you, bosses Scully around, you go do the autopsy, I'm going to go do something else, kind of Mulder jerk moment. And I wasn't sure if this was the first or one of the first or where it runs in and what you thought about that.
Yeah, it kind of struck me as a bit as like, they're partners. Why is he telling her to go off and do this? And Scully does question. She's like, well, why am I... I forget exactly what she says, but she basically is like, well, why aren't I going with you? He's like, oh, well, I had the autopsy scheduled for 7. And you get a little bit of a Sully sarcastic sigh in there, like, oh, fine, I'll go cut up bodies for this. But it could also show, you know, that I think he's... kind of when you get comfortable with your friends, you do start to boss them around a little more than when you're just starting out with them. So it could actually show, if you look at it a different way, more of the growth in their relationship. Like, he knows Scully's a strong, tough woman and partner, and he feels okay with, like, hey, I can boss you around, and I can tell you what to do because I know I'm going to get it back at some point.
Interesting perspective. But no, that's a good point. That's a really good point, because it's often talked about simply that, you know, Mulder's just a callous jerk. And it's nice to, you know, have a... there is a positive interpretation, because he wouldn't do that if he didn't think they were good enough friends to be able to do that. So I don't think Mulder would intentionally alienate her that much as he can be oblivious to, you know, human emotions.
I think that's what it is. I mean, he is sometimes oblivious. He gets really focused on what he wants and what he believes in, and he just kind of loses sight of what he's saying and how he's saying it to people, which, you know, isn't that rare for coworkers, particularly male coworkers, no offense, that I've had in the past, that I know have acted like that. And it's not trying to be insulting or trying to be rude. It just kind of comes out that way.
All good points. What did you think about the massive collection of disfigured dolls that the therapist kept?
I'm a big fan of disfigured dolls. I use one in my own novel.
Can we use that as a poll quote for your future novel?
Absolutely.
All right.
Dolls have always freaked me out as a child. My sister had a porcelain doll collection, and she would sneak them into my room and have them stare at me. Whenever I see a doll being used in a creepy way, I can identify with it. So that does stand out as a nice highlight. And I guess the therapist kept them as, like, some sort of evidence of her sessions. It does seem weird. She has an entire closet just full of disfigured dolls.
Would you like, at this point, to make a formal statement to your sister about the childhood trauma she inflicted?
She is well aware of the situation. And,
okay. We'll table it for now. That's fine. We'll wait for small claims court. This is also one of the another episode that highlights hypnosis and the ongoing debate the show does with it. How do you think it played off? Do you think it was an effective use of the story time or a pointless red herring? What did you think? How do you think of the way the hypnosis translated into the image into the video cassette and that as a lead that only paid off at the very end?
I think the fact that he wanted to go to hypnosis made sense because at this point they thought it had something to do with reincarnation, and that is something that they use to try to, like, go into previous lives, which happens much later in when Mulder has his own episode about reincarnation a couple seasons later. But the session itself, it was just so quick and just not very believable. I mean, like, the kid sitting there with her eyes open and she just starts kind of screaming stuff. And her mom runs in and comforts her, and suddenly she's out of hypnosis, which I'm not an expert, but I didn't think that's how you can come out of deep hypnosis, just by your mom hugging you. And I'm still not sure how the image ended up on the video camera, because it wasn't even an image of, like, the man that was killed. It was his last image of what he saw before he died, which is what leads them to the fish tank, because it's that little scuba diving figure. And that didn't seem to make much sense. Like, if I thought I'd see an image, I thought it would be, like, that spirit of that person kind of in the room with them. And instead, it's kind of the vision of what the spirit saw. So I'm still not sure how they decided to, or why they decided to go with that leap.
Perhaps, and I'm just going on a limb here, perhaps because since they're doing regression, the idea is that she's regressing back into the mind of the person at the time, of the previous person that is possessing her now.
Mm-hmm. And that makes sense, as opposed to
her being controlled or seen through the ghost or the spirit.
Yeah, I think...
if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And I think maybe if they even had, like, electrodes or something on her head to monitor, it would make more sense that we're seen inside her thoughts as opposed
to... Oh, yeah, why it's on the tape. Totally. I mean, I would also go, how in the world can she change computer software?
Yeah.
So I had to...
you know, make magic mustaches appear and the rest. So I can't argue with that. No.
A lot of technology issues in this one.
I'm going to, just because we're kind of heading down the road, hit a speed round and see if you have any comments about any of these. I don't know if you noticed, but it was one of the most animated corpses the X-Files has ever had, I believe. And that just in the few seconds of screen time, the stomach and chest moved an incredible amount. I don't know if you noticed
I did not, but I'm terrible about picking up on continuity errors.
It's pointless. It's not really continuity. It just was so intense. You'd think somebody... I don't mind it if I see a corpse breathing. You know, it's an actor. This is make-believe. That's fine. This was... It almost looked as if they were laughing. It was pretty fun. But if you go back and watch it, focus on the couch. The corpse doesn't matter. It's all about the couch. What about this? The one of the plot things that didn't make much sense to me was they were waiting 10 years to do something with the money, but it had been 9 years. And why weren't they motivated, or what was the motivation preventing them from just taking and splitting the money then? Why did they have to wait? until all 10 years were up. I didn't get that.
My hypothesis was, I guess, to kind of allay suspicion on them for why this original detective was killed, and they figured 10 years was going to be a long enough time frame.
I mean, it's arbitrary. Why, if it's 9.5 and the heat is on,
because
why would another 6 months matter?
A 9-year-old girl is pretty creepy. So that's a good point. Yeah, it doesn't really... It gave him an excuse to kill off that other guy, pretty much.
Good enough. Get out of there, bad guy. Die.
Need to get her scarf caught in a bus.
Yeah, I liked that. I don't like seeing, violence, but I thought just the whole very gently lifting up in there, the whole scene, and it was nice because it subverted my expectations because I was like, oh, come on. How can the bus driver not hear? And then as soon as you think that, the bus driver hears and tries to stop and then does the gas pedal and dies. I actually liked that scene, even though I'm not a big fan of death scenes. It give me the nightmares. What did you think about one of the few mid-episode monologues for a journal? And Mulder is not doing it on a computer. He's actually handwriting, but it's similar to some of the earlier season episodes where they'll end with a computer journal kind of wrapping up the case. I thought that was kind of a nice touch to kind of give a pause, a little breath in the middle of the episode.
Yeah, I mean, I get so used to those. I mean, I think when I picture Scully and Mulder, I picture them in front of the computer tapping away, kind of recapping their X-File. So I think it did give it a nice pause to see into Mulder's head and where he was at right now. At the same time, though, the episode, like I said earlier, for me does lag a bit, so it mm-hmm. could have been something they could have cut to keep the pace going.
You got a point. You got a point. Well, any last comments about Born Again before we sum up with a rating?
I just think, Born Again does a few things like with messing with machinery and getting revenge after death that the series really does better in other episodes like Ghost in the Machine and later episodes like The Field Where I Died, where Mulder looks at his own reincarnation. So it's almost like it's taking different elements from episodes that were done better in other episodes.
Including the next one.
Yes, which is a very similar.
What kind of rating would you give this episode out of 10?
I'm going to be rough on this one. I'm going to give it a 4 for me.
All right. Well, I had pre-ranked it as a 3.5. So we're fairly similar. And I want to be clear on that is assuming all X-Files episodes are evenly distributed so that you have to have a smooth curve for all things, a 3.5. So I'm not going to say it's this horrible, horrible thing, but... IMDb, just as a side note, gave it a 7.3. And as XCast hosts often mention, that's got a huge curve, which pretty much starts at 6.5, I think, and ends at 9.
Mm-hmm. So
that's pretty high, considering that they gave Tombs 8.5 and Darkness Falls, we talked about the previous episodes, 8.6. Not much of a difference there. Another thing I wanted to talk about a little bit is Lauren Forey, co-host on this episode today, has done some excellent writing for some of the recent canon X-Files anthologies. If you listen to the previous episode about Darkness Falls and Tombs, you'll be able to hear a little bit about some of those writings. But I also wanted to briefly touch on some of the other work that you've done. Right now, if we could talk a little bit about Abigail Hall. Can you tell us a little bit about the book and if it would be of interest to X-Files fans?
Any of the X-Files fans that like the gothic horror, haunted house stories, that's what this is in the vein of. It's set in post-war Britain. Which, if you don't know, is a very depressing time, where they're in a severe depression, things are worse than they were during the war, and lots of people hate each other, so it's a great setting for a horror story. And in typical gothic horror tradition, some innocent young girls get sent out to work at a mysterious house they know nothing about, and terrible, terrible things happen. And one of my favorite parts of this book is that it's two sisters, and the younger sister starts to go a bit crazy. In the nice X-Files tradition of having creepy children, she turns into quite a creepy child. And plus, like we talked again with Born Again, there are some creepy mutilated dolls as well, which, might have been in my subconscious from that X-Files episode when I wrote this.
Oh, boy, that X-Files is the gift that keeps giving. So
does
X-Files inspire your writing a lot? I mean, was it something that inspired you to become a writer?
I think as far back as I can remember, I was always writing these little creepy stories about, like, blobs eating people and children disappearing in cornfields, and I read a lot of R.L. Stein, and I don't know if I liked X-Files because I read R.L. Stein, or if I read R.L. Stein books because I loved X-Files. It kind of all happened at the same time. But definitely just like, I like to put in my work the realness that the X-Files has, that we've talked about, how it's, these are supernatural and strange things are happening, but they feel like they're happening in our world. And that's the type of stories I like to write, with like a really grounded, realistic setting, because I find those more terrifying than others, that it's completely out there in a world we can't relate to as clearly.
I'm a big fan of classic ghost story, so I'm definitely going to have to check it out. But yeah, thanks for sharing this with us. And again, keep writing for the X-Files. If you've been following along, if you listen to any more of our episodes in this Podwatch, find out that got a few other good ideas, short stories for Lauren to write for us. So let's all join in and nag the publishers. Okay, now we're going to be talking about the episode Roland, which originally aired on May 6th, 1994. It is episode number 22. It was written by Chris Ruppenthal and directed by the classic X-Files director David Nutter. It starts off in the Washington, or the Mahan, Washington Institute of Technology in Colson, Washington, where there is the janitor, Roland Fuller, working with a bunch of scientists who are doing some work on jet propulsion and trying to reach Mach 15. One of the scientists is killed by being trapped in the room with Roland, and Mulder and Scully are called in to investigate. More scientists continue to die, find out that one of the scientists who used to work there was killed, but his brain has been cryogenically frozen and seems to be controlling his twin brother, who was the janitor, Roland, and helping to finish his work and then also get revenge on some of the scientists. At the end of the episode, the scientist whose brain was frozen, Arthur Grable, eventually is defrosted by the villain scientist. We find out that, again, there, Arthur is a twin brother of Roland. And then Roland, under the control of Arthur, almost kills the other scientist, Dr. Nolet. And then eventually Arthur loses control of Roland. Roland is free, gets transferred to a psych ward. There's some other nice little elements we'll talk about in the episode, but that's a basic summary. Overall, what did you think about Roland, and what are some of the highlights for you?
I think one of the highlights is the death that you mentioned. It's another classic X-Files death, where the guy gets sucked into, you know, it's the wind turbine, whatever, they're building the engines, and you don't see it, you just know what's happening. The guy goes past the window and his screaming stops. And I always thought, you know, oh, is there going to be some blood on the window or not? But there isn't. There's just nothing. And you can just use your imagination to know exactly what happened to that man and how little of him is left. And it has another creative death later. Arthur controlling Roland kills one of the other scientists by dipping his head in, what was that, liquid nitrogen, yeah. Ditches have liquid nitrogen and then smashes it against the floor and it, you know, breaks like glass, which I thought, you know, everybody likes to use in stories liquid nitrogen like that, but it's a nice, clever use of a death, so not just drowning, but drowning and head breaking open. So for that, it just made it, yeah, a really interesting episode for me, the creative measures of death that Arthur/Roland goes to.
I was wondering when I was watching it if the liquid nitrogen death was inspired by Terminator 2, which is 3 years previous, but still a big influence. But I thought the sound effects when they did it and then showing the broken corpse was a really effective death scene. So I can't argue with that at all. I don't know if anyone cares, but there is no Colson, Washington. So what's one of those fake X-Files town names that sounds like it could be real? Although there is also no Washington Institute of Technology. The state is just, it's not big enough to support something that intense. But they did have a fake hospital name that I really liked as a Washingtonian myself, a Puget Presbyterian Hospital. That sounded legitimate. They did a great job on coming up with that one. So there's, right off the beginning, there's a little moment. I don't know if you consider yourself a shipper, but where Scully's talking about a wedding, and Mulder asks if she caught the bouquet, and she responds, maybe.
Yeah, I wrote down about the wedding in my notes, because it's one of those great moments of Scully humor, because even if she talks about the wedding, wasn't there something like it involved like goats or something? She rattles off kind of like all these crazy events that happened at this wedding, and then Mulder asks about the bouquet. I know, I was sitting there, I was wondering, I want to know more about this wedding. Like, who was getting married? How crazy was this wedding? But yeah, that moment with the bouquet, it was a really nice touch. Because it's him, you know, kind of flirting with her, and she doesn't shut it down with her maybe. She's comfortable enough, they're comfortable with enough each other at this point to give that flirting right back to him.
Yeah, so I'm sorry right now. I'm composing an email here to the editors of the next Secret Agendas here. Let's see, okay, Lauren Forey filling gap story for Roland Scully wedding adventure. Bam. Okay, I just had to send that off. I hope that's okay to do that on your behalf.
Perfect. And you can have a whole subplot of, like, just Mulder at home eating sunflower seeds and, like, his underwear or something, and nothing's happening to him. And Scully on some sort of whirlwind adventure tour trying to keep a wedding under control. I like it.
I'm sorry, but I could imagine 90% of X-Files fans would kill for that story. I think it's something that should be written, and I think you are the person for the job.
Excellent. I'll get right on that.
Speaking of when we talked about just previously Born Again, about kind of giving up the plot a little too early, that was one of my criticisms of this episode, is that the different handwriting, the math, and the flashbacks, flash forwards, and all of that. I thought a little too early we knew what was going on. Did that work against it for you, or was that fine when it came to the pacing?
It did. It was something else I noted. It maintains its mystery a little better for me than Born Again, because we don't know what Arthur's motivation is. Like, we don't know, was he murdered in that car accident? Why is he killing these scientists? So even once we found out the connection between Arthur and Roland, I still found myself, like, wanting to know, okay, but so what, why? What's the big, you know, mystery behind this? Whereas in Born Again, we kind of get everything at once. Who's doing it and why and what their plan is altogether. But yeah, it did. I think they didn't have to do the Roland having those dreams of the two little boys being split up, because then it was obvious. You know, oh, they're related. They're twin brothers. They could have done more with those flashback scenes. Every time Roland had to flashback, it was to the same exact moment, and it was the same exact clip. Which I get helps reduce costs, but if they had, like, teased it out a little more, like, first you just see a boy playing in the woods, or then maybe next time that you see has a brother, and then next time you see them being pulled apart, I think that could have added a little bit more mystery to it.
And, honestly, if you're going to go through all the work to dress up kids and be in the set, it's not going to take that much more money to just go over those trees and run around and chase each other.
Mm-hmm. So I think you got a good production call there. I'm not going to argue with that at all. This episode also has another amusing
photo editing session. Oh, this one I really enjoyed. The keyboard.
Being able to pull off all of those hilarious functions. So, but I won't dwell on it because we already passed that one down.
I kept thinking there must be another photo of this Arthur guy around. Like, there has to be a photo of him when he was younger or with his stuff, with his parents, where he doesn't have a beard. And they could have just done that, and that would have made more sense.
Yeah, I mean, considering he's a fairly well-known academic, there's got to be annuals or something else even from high school you could get. One thing I liked about this episode, I liked the character and the actress who was the FBI handwriting analyst. She was only in it for a little bit. But I thought, you know, she really nailed the part, and thought this should have been a recurring character. Obviously, they don't probably need handwriting analysis in a lot of episodes, but could have just been another general purpose FBI agent who could have assisted.
What X-Files always does really well, I think, are secondary characters, which you need good ones when you're doing a show like this, where you're doing different cases each week. You have to have characters that can hold their own against Mulder and Scully, and the best episodes do that. It would be fun to have more if they maybe would have had more of like a set core of, like, you know, specialists, almost like, well, Hannibal did really recently. Like, they had the whole team that would pop up every once in a while to help solve the cases. But yeah, she could have probably used some more handwriting, or maybe she could have another specialty in something else.
Yes. Yeah, all right, so I got a second vote. And this will be Secret Origins Volume 6. The Special Adventures of Handwriting and Analyst, written by Lauren Forey. Again, okay, just sent that email off. Back to the podcast. What now did you think about the primary performance of Roland?
Roland, it's an interesting performance for me. I love the actor who, I can never pronounce his name. It's the Zelto Ivanek. I tried to even look up pronunciation, but he's a famous actor. He pops up in everything nowadays. What is he? He's on the Good Wife. Madam Secretary and some others and some films. He always had kind of that guy, that analysis guy in the background. And I think he did a really good job of making Roland believable. Like, you felt for Roland. At the same time, they mention as Roland was supposed to be autistic. And from what I know in my experience of working with autistic children and adults, his portrayal didn't seem to be portraying autism, as opposed to maybe some other form of disability.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a tricky thing, is to take a condition and portray it as someone who does not have that condition.
I think it was a very sensitive performance. They showed what Roland really was capable of, and that he was a good person, and he felt bad for what was happening. And he has all these scenes with the other girl he lives with that has a crush on him that I thought were really sweet. And I think it showed people with disabilities or like being they are regular people, and they have their loves and they have their faults and they have their worries. So it was nice to have those scenes in there where it was just kind of those two characters talking without needing like an intermediary or an aide or something. I think that's why I think some of the best episodes, like Darkness Falls, we've talked with, that has Titus Welliver, and then this one with Ivanek. Those are the ones that really kind of last. These actors went on to do more things, and that
yeah.
ability that they show there is what helps elevate these episodes.
It's, the X-Files is this wonderful launching pad for so many talented people. And I will just kind of go on and echo that about his performances. And I think also the way, you know, the script portrays it is they don't play it up to make the character overly sympathetic in an unrealistic way. He's very sympathetic, but they don't oversimplify him by any means. And in such a short time, he's able to put quite a bit of nuance into the character. And particularly one of my favorite things about the episode is the very end, the epilogue, and when Roland walks into the bathroom, looks in the mirror with the hairbrush, mm-hmm. and just that little scene there and how he plays it, I thought was excellent. And that really knocked the episode up a few points for me. How did you think about how the episode wrapped up? Sorry to cut you off.
I think for me, for the ending, what was still unclear was Arthur's intention. Like, I know he wanted to finish his work, but for me, he didn't have a clear enough motivation to want to kill the other scientists, because it was made clear, I felt, at the end that his car accident was an accident. Nobody tried to kill him. Nobody sabotaged his car. Mm-hmm. So he had no reason to get revenge, and he was just kind of pissed off that these other guys were going to finish your work. But what else would they do if you died? That's, you know, they're going to continue doing it. So I think they should have built in more backstory or given him more of a motivation to murder these guys, because everybody seemed to like him when he was alive. He was a practical joker. He was a genius. They were working well. Because if I was one of those scientists, I'd be like, oh, he's great. He's sort of back from the dead. We can finish this work and get this breakthrough. So that, for me, wasn't as clear. But I think the ending, how they ended it with, you know, Roland being the one who's able to remember and figure out how to shut off the machine, and allowing Roland to redeem himself a little bit, even for all the terrible things that Arthur has done, and saving that last life, I think worked well.
I cannot argue with that. In fact, I've kind of blacked out from my memory the whole subplot. I know it's in there and I even talked about it, but boy, does it not interest me, because between Arthur Grable and the other scientists is, like you said, at worst, it's plagiarism. You know, is that worth murder? And the Dr. Nolet, the main villain, the performance there is so campy that I made notes when I was watching this that is one of those few performances. Sometimes if you have a really bad performance next to an okay performance, it makes the okay performance look better in the context, out of contrast. But when they were both on screen together, it just drug down the entire scene, no matter how good Ivanek's performance was. And so, yeah, the whole idea, I mean, it's so campy. You've got a brain in the jar, basically, a brain in the jar, classic sci-fi plot with a crazy scientist academic villain. It seemed like a completely separate story from the main Roland plot line of we're dealing with that character. But when they intermix too closely, I don't think it worked. But I did enjoy the pacing of the plotting where we're just following Roland and his life.
Yeah, I think they could have found some other motivation to give him, to give Arthur for the scientist.
I think it's a good point. No arguments. What would you give it out of 10?
I'm going to give this one a 7, and bumping that up to a 7 because of Ivanek's performance.
Great. I think that's a totally fair thing. Again, because I'm spreading them out against all X-Files episodes, assuming they have to, you know, fill the whole curve, I'm actually going to give it right in the middle a 5. I think there's a lot of great things about it, but the overall plot with the scientists and the rest drag it down well below 5. But it's Ivanek's performance that pulls it up to there for me. IMDb actually gave it 7.4, so it's a 0.1 above what they gave Born Again. Overall, pretty high for season 1, it seems. Thanks again, everybody, for listening, and thank you, Lauren, for chatting with me about these two episodes. You can reach the XCast a few different ways in social media, so we're on Twitter, @X_cast, and we have a Facebook page and group, the XCast X-Files Podcast Fan Group. So in the next episodes, the next episodes to be covered on Podwatch are going to be the classic Erlenmeyer Flask, wrapping up season 1, and then following up into Little Green Men. Until next time, trust the one.